Welcome to the Reality Revolution. I'm your host, Brian Scott. We have another lecture from Neville Goddard today. This one delivered in 1971 on June 21st, called The Secret of Imagination. These later lectures you'll find to be quite different than many of the lectures we've gone over. This is very close to the time of his death. And whenever he talks about imagination, it's always quite different and very powerful. The Secret of Imagination. I thought that this last week should be both practical and idealistic, so we will start on the practical side. He said, "Think not that I come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have come not to abolish the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them." Matthew 5:17. Now, the one speaking is now present within you. When he awakes, you will hear these words. You will find them to be your words. That one is your own wonderful human imagination. That one is God. Imagination is the basis of all that is. What is now proved to be true, as far as we are concerned, was once only imagined. Think of something in this world that is now to you real, that wasn't first imagined. So the secret of imagining is the secret of God. And so, the secret of imagining is the greatest of all problems, to the solution of which everyone should aspire. Because the supreme power, supreme wisdom, supreme delight lie in the far-off solution of this mystery. Douglas Fawcett, author of Zermatt Dialogues and the Oberlin Dialogues. I can acquaint you with it and then leave you to your choice and its risk, because everything in the world is created by this power. He said, "I kill and I make alive, I wound and I heal, and there is none that can deliver out of my hand." Deuteronomy 32:39. I create the light and make the darkness. I create woe and I make weal. Isaiah 45:7. I, even I, am he, and there is none that can deliver out of my hand. Deuteronomy 32:39. That's your own wonderful human imagination. Well, there are secrets to this power, and you and I might experiment. We try to discover the secret. As we discover the secret of imagining, we are discovering the secret of God. So God and imagination, the human imagination, are synonymous terms. They are interchangeable. So when we read that, if we know that he hears us in whatever we ask, we know that we have obtained that which we requested of him. 1 John 5:15. If we know that he hears us in whatever we ask, no restraint. Now, you may sit down and commune with what you think to be another than yourself. But because there are billions of us in the world, and there is but one God in this fabulous universe, you might wonder if he hears you. But you have no doubt in your mind, if you identify God with your own wonderful human imagination, that he hears you. Can you believe that your own wonderful human imagination is God? So when you sit down, as told in the fourth psalm, commune with your own hearts upon your beds and be silent. Psalm 4:4. He hears you if you commune with self, because you believe that communion with self was communion with God. Can you, now, assume that you are the one that you would like to be? Can you assume that one that you love is as you would like her or would like him to be? Can you really believe that you are answered? I do not expect tonight that after a certain conception the child will be born tomorrow. Vision has its own appointed hour. It ripens, it will flower. If it be long, then wait. For it is sure, and it will not be late. Habakkuk 2:3. A little child takes 9 months, a lamb 5 months, a chicken 21 days, the elephant, so they tell me, a year or more, a horse, a year anyway. So every conception has its own appointed hour. It ripens, it will flower. If it seems to you long, then wait. It is sure, it will not be late, relative to its own nature. So can I now commune and expect that my communion with self is communion with God? Can I dare to assume that I am exactly what I want to be? Can I dare to assume that I am where I want to be? Even though at the moment my reason denies it, my senses deny it, will it work? Well, it costs you nothing. Try it. It doesn't cost me one penny to try it. As you are told, come buy wine, buy milk, without money, without price, Isaiah 55:1, and take it. It doesn't cost you one penny to dare to assume that you are where you'd like to be, though at the moment reason denies that you are. Now I'm telling you what I know from experience. When I didn't have a nickel and desired a trip that would cost me well in excess of $1,000, I dared to assume that I was where I would like to be, and I viewed the world from that assumption. Instead of thinking of it, I thought from it. Then I thought of where physically I was, and I saw that place in my imagination 2,000 miles to the northwest of me. And I slept in that assumption, and then in a way that I did not consciously devise, I had no way of knowing how it would ever work, but in a way I did not know, it unfolded, and that assumption hardened into fact. On the strength of that, I tried it again and again, and when it worked, I began to teach it. I began to tell others that their imagination is the cause of the phenomena of life. This was long before I realized the promise, as we call it in Scripture. This was only the law, so we are told, "Blessed is the man who delights in the law of the Lord. In all that he does, he prospers." Psalm 1:1-3. He didn't say if it was good for you. He left that entirely up to you to make the decision. You could choose something that may be horrible in time. You could choose it without contemplating the consequences, but he tells you your imaginal act is a fact. Now, as he awakens within you, he reinterprets the law. He can't chance the law, he interprets the law. Instead of abiding by the external traditions of our fathers, he tells us what the law really is when he awakens within us. You have heard it said of old, "You shall not commit adultery." But I say to you, any of you who looks lustfully upon a woman has already committed the act in his heart with her. Matthew 5:27. He tells us that the restraint of that impulse is not enough. The act was committed at the moment of the imaginal act. I may contemplate the consequences and be afraid. My reputation would be at stake if they catch me. But at the very moment of the imaginal act, that was the fact. That's how he interprets the law. Well, now, no one can stop you from imagining. No one can stop you from imagining that you are secure. But you may say, "I have no one in this world to whom I could turn who would leave me a penny, and I have no money. I'm beyond the age where they would employ me," and you could give yourself 1,000 reasons why it could not be. He is not asking for any reasons. Can you imagine? Well, who can stop you from imagining? That's all that concerns the awakened man within you. Can I dare imagine that I am what I want to be? Well, I have done it unnumbered times. I've done it successfully for many that I love dearly, and many that I do not know. I have failed often too, but the failure is in me. It is not in the law. Imagination plus faith is the stuff out of which we make the world. We are told all things were made in this manner. He calls a thing that is not seen as though it were seen, and the unseen becomes seen. Romans 4:17. And when I come to him, I must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who believe in him. I must have faith in the imaginal act. If tonight I can stand here and simply quietly imagine a state, really believe that I'm in communion with God when I did that, and that my imaginal act is God's act, it's not something other than God, and go unconcerned as to the result, the results will follow me. For that imaginal act was causal at the moment that I did it. The effect, when it appears, I may try to trace the effect to some physical cause and give all credit to a physical cause. I tell you, every physical effect has an imaginal cause and not a physical cause. A physical cause only seems it is a delusion of our fading memory. We do not remember when we imagined it. In this audience tonight, and he may not even remember when he did it, is my dentist. I went to him in great need of a lot of work, but I've had dentistry all over this country and in London and Barbados, but it was all horrible. I was always on the move. I was with the theater, getting in town for a week. What could they do when I needed such work? They patched me up. So I met him. He gave me a complete job because I was here, living here then. When one day a tooth gave way, which was an anchor tooth, he said to me quite innocently, whether he remembers it or not, "When I saw your mouth and did this, I said to myself, this tooth will last 13 years. It was 13 years. Had he only said 25, but he didn't think I would live that long. So 13 years, out came that anchor tooth, and therefore a complete restructure of my entire mouth. He set it in motion. Whether he remembers or not, he said, this is going to last 13 years. He didn't tell me, he didn't have to tell me. That was his imaginal act. I was only the victim of his creative power. Now I am telling you, don't take anything lightly. You are creating morning, noon, and night. Your imaginal acts are God's acts, because your imagination is God, and there is no other God. God actually became as we are, became man that man may become God. Blake from There Is No Natural Religion. And he has set up within himself, in man, a series of events which he will now unfold within man, which the one in whom he unfolds will know he is God. He calls it giving glory unto man. I will not give my glory to another, he said. I have tried you in the furnace of affliction. For my own sake I do it, for my own sake. For how should my name be profaned? My glory I will not give to another. Isaiah 48:11. God's glory is God, as told us in the 33rd chapter of the book of Exodus. I will make my glory to pass before you. Exodus 33:19, and I will cover you until I have passed by. 33:27. So my glory is equated with the eye of God, for his name is I am. He cannot give his glory, which is himself, to another. So in becoming man, he puts man in the furnaces. But then read the story carefully. He took upon himself all of my infirmities and bore my diseases. Who else suffers? I will say, but I suffer. Well, that's God. But I am feeling it. He isn't. That is, no, he. His name is I am. So I feel the pain. I feel the infirmity. I feel the diseases. That's God. So the fool says in his heart, there is no God nor son of God, that thou, O human imagination, art all a delusion. But I know thee, O Lord, when thou arisest upon my weary eyes, even in this dungeon and this iron mill, thou also sufferest with me, although I behold thee not. William Blake from Jerusalem. I do not behold imagination as I behold an object in space. I am the reality that is named imagination, but I cannot actually see it as an object in space. I see the results of my imagining, but not the being imagining it, for God is invisible. When the voice replied, fear not, I am with you always. Can I ever get away from my imagining? If I fall asleep now and I start dreaming, what is dreaming but imagining? When I awake, he is still with me and I am still imagining. I am with you always. I am with you always. Only believe in me that I have power to raise from death thy brother who sleeps in Albion. Blake from Jerusalem. This comes now to the promise that he made to all of us. His promise is to give himself to us as though there were no others in the world, just you. Because in giving himself to you, there is no other. The whole vast world is yourself pushed out. Everything in the world is yourself pushed out, and you manipulate it by your imaginal acts. Everything in the world. Now the first act begins with the resurrection. It's not outside of you, in spite of what you have been taught. The day will come, you will rise within yourself. And that's the only God that was ever resurrected. Who will ever be resurrected? It's not another. It's you. And when you rise, there is no one on the outside. It's all you. And you are rising in the only tomb in the world where God was ever buried. And that's your own skull. God is buried in the human skull, and that's where he rises. And when he rises, as foretold by his own words in Scripture, he is born. Resurrection begins the act. That same night, you come out of the tomb, which is your skull, and you are born from above, and not from the womb of woman where the garment was born. You are born from above, born of God, born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. John 1:13. In other words, you are self-begotten. God begets himself, as told us in the epistle to the Hebrews. He is bringing many sons to glory. Hebrews 2:10. But the sons are numbered. Every one born of woman is that son of God, as told us in the 32nd chapter of Deuteronomy. He has set bounds to the peoples of earth according to the number of the sons of God, Deuteronomy 32:8. But you will say, but look, there are 3 billion in the world. So what's that? I will make them more numerous than the stars, more numerous than the sands of the beach, Hebrews 11:12. We'll count them. You can't count the stars. We estimate there to be trillions and trillions. These are the sons of God, bringing each that he chooses. He didn't bring all together. He brought a certain number, and that certain number he calls the second son. The second son is represented by this fabulous number. The first son is still waiting to come out. He complains because the second son went berserk, went amok, and used his power unwisely. Then he came to his senses and returned to his father, and the father embraced him and gave him the authority of himself. He gave him the ring, the robe, the fatted calf, everything for the one who went out and came back to the father. For his gift is the gift of himself to you who came out. I chose you in me before the foundation of the world. See Ephesians 1-4. That's what we are told. Let the first son complain. He will complain and complain. I served you, and you gave me nothing, not even a kid. He said, my son, all that I have is yours. But the most fabulous gift in the world or possession in the world is without meaning unless there is knowledge of it and a readiness to use it. Going out as we did, we became aware of our possessions. Then we can use it. Unless we went out into the world and misused it as we have done, we could not have become aware of this power that is our own creative power, our imagination. I saw it so clearly one night. Here I am in this fabulous field of sunflowers, huge, lovely sunflowers. Each sunflower was a face, the human face. But they were all anchored in the earth, and I walked up and down among the sunflowers. They moved like an orchestra moves. They all moved in unison. One smiled, they all smiled. If one didn't smile, no one smiled. They simply followed like an orchestra. If one bent over, they all bent over, and everyone did what the whole did. They automatically did it, and I felt, though I was alone, I could walk up and down. They were anchored. They couldn't do it. I felt that I was freer, limited as I was. Then all of them put together, beautiful as they were, these sunflowers were human faces, but they had not gone out. I was once a part of that infinite garden, not aware of what I possessed. And my father chose me in him before the foundation of the world, and I went out to go through hell in this world, that I may become aware that all thine are mine. To become aware that all that is God's belonged to me, I had to go through the furnaces of affliction. And having gone through the furnaces, then he awakes within me. He tells me how I will know he has awakened in me. He set up in the beginning the result of the experiences of humanity, and that result is a son, and the son is called David. And when I find him, I will know he is my son, and I will know the 89th Psalm. I have found David. He has cried unto me, thou art my father, my God, and the rock of my salvation. Well, I found him, and he cried those words to me, and I knew exactly who he was, and I knew then who I am until then. I did not know I was one with God. He is God's son, God's only son. Now he's my son. I tell you, you are going to find him, and he will be your son. And because he is my son, you and I are one. He can be your son, and I know he's my son, and you and I not be one father? So we are told there is only one body, one spirit, one Lord, one God, and Father of all. So in the end, there will not be Greek or Jew, bond and free, male and female, but only all in one God, and you will be that God. So this is the promise that he made. For when I read the Bible, I take all the related parts of the promise and put them all together. For all these things put together will find their fulfillment in you. All his promises find their yes in him. As you read it in the 2 Corinthians, all promises of God find their yes, their fulfillment in him. 2 Corinthians 1:20. So there are 39 books together, they form one book. But the context, which means the meaning of it, you will find scattered over the 39. He pulls from this, from that, from the other, written over the centuries, and pulls it into one pattern. For Christ is the pattern man. That pattern is buried in man. It's the only Christ in the world. When the pattern unfolds in man, it unfolds in man as the man in whom it unfolds. And then he knows who he is. And he has no doubt in his mind as to who he is. He is the Lord spoken of in Scripture, and that Lord is God the Father, and the whole thing unfolds within him. But he does not abolish the law that he gave. He explains the law as a psychological law and not a physical law. But if I long after someone at that very moment the act was committed, I state it boldly. I stated boldly as my dentist stated it boldly. It was committed. So I went blindly on enjoying everything that he did. It was perfect. And suddenly comes a little bleeding thing which no one could stop. Out comes the tooth. He set in motion the day he set to himself, not to me. It will last 13 years. I checked it. It was 13 years. So Blake said in his wonderful Jerusalem, "Oh, what have I said? What have I done? Oh, all-powerful human words. For the word of man is the word of God, and the word shall not return unto me void, but it must accomplish that which I propose and prosper in the thing for which I sent it." Isaiah 55:11. But man forgets his word. Then it comes up and he looks for physical causes for it. Now he'll start searching. Did you know what? Well, your system is run down. You have a fever. Did you have so-and-so and so-and-so? And you ask 1,000 questions of the one. Did you have so-and-so? You said, no, no, no. No one thinks of that moment when the word went out. Well, the word goes forward, and it cannot return unto us void. It must accomplish that which we proposed and prosper in the thing for which I sent it. I can see my father now. Back in 1919, there were 10 of us, 9 boys and a girl. He was a ship chandler. He had a grocery store, a liquor store, and a meat store, a regular little grocery. He supplied ships, and the ships were bringing the boys back from the First World War. And they would tell him all kinds of stories. At dinner, he would say to my mother, "We will have another war in 20 years. In 20 years, there will be another war. It is Germany, but this time it's going to be Germany and Japan." He didn't mention Italy, but it will be Germany and Japan. We will then have America as our ally. France will be our ally. Mother would say, "Joseph, we have 9 sons. In 20 years, they will all be eligible to go to war." We were all kids in 1919. I was 14 years old. In 1939, on the first day of September, war broke. Exactly 20 years. What did my father know of any prophecy concerning this? He was only repeating what he had heard from the captains and the stewards and the chief officers as he did business with them. But they were his words. And he said it with conviction because he believed these men knew what they were talking about. In our headlines, day after day, they are setting the picture in motion for tomorrow's confusion. The men are paid enormous salaries to write scare headlines. All right, so he writes a scare headline thinking, it only sells the paper. It's not going to hurt anyone. But we're going to fulfill them. We fulfill all of our words because God and man are one. Man is all imagination. And God is man and exists in us and we in him. Blake from Annotations to Berkeley. The eternal body of man is the imagination, and that is God himself. Blake from the Lacoon. And God's word is man's word, and it cannot return unto him void. It just can't. If he speaks with conviction, so imagination plus faith, these are the very stuff out of which we fashion our world. So can I tonight be alone and commune with myself and be confident that he heard me? I know that I heard myself. Well, that self is God. If we know that he hears us in whatever we ask, we know we have obtained. Not are going to. We have obtained that which we request of him. Read it in John's epistle, the first epistle, the 5th chapter, the 15th verse. We have obtained it. Well, it must take a little interval. It may come tonight. Depending on what seed you planted. One seed will grow overnight. Other seeds will take a little longer, but each has its own appointed hour. There's not a thing wrong in your noble dreams in this world. You want to be wealthy? What is wrong with it? You want to be anything? What is wrong with it? Everything is possible. A friend of mine called me last week. He's now appointed the head purchasing agent of the city of Culver. By law, he's not qualified. He does not have the educational background. The law demands you must have a college degree. He doesn't have anything outside of high school. They rearranged it to appoint him the head purchasing agent of Culver City. Why? He came here. He and his brother, I buried the brother a few years ago. He got this job, not dreaming for one moment he could ever transcend it. I said, don't for one moment entertain that thought. The job is yours if you want it. Don't push the other one out. He can go higher. You want to be the purchasing agent of the whole city of Culver? You are the purchasing agent. Sleep in it just as though it were true, and you hurt no one. Last week, they rearranged the law and he was appointed the purchasing agent to take effect in July. Now everything was rearranged. Everything will be rearranged for you. A friend of mine told me here that you aren't allowed to speak at any state university unless you have a college degree. Well, he confessed that he did not have one, but he was invited by a professor at UCLA to take his class. I think there were three or four classes in the use of imagination in advertising. So here he went in without the degree and was given all the freedom that the professor enjoyed. He gave either three or four lectures instead of the professor who went off for those three or four lectures. So they suspended the rules. They can suspend every rule. They are not supposed to do this, not supposed to do that. Ignore it. Ignore everything. My friend used to say to me, "You can't smoke in here. Look, no smoking." And he was a very wonderful lad. He said, they didn't say it positively. And he would go right through the gate to the airplane. And I would say, "Mort, you cannot smoke in here. You're not supposed to smoke." It didn't say positively. And here's Mort going right through with his cigarette. No one stopped him. I'm not saying you should do it. He didn't do it to brag. He simply believed in himself. He wouldn't hurt anyone. Now, you don't have to hurt anyone. I tell you, your own wonderful human imagination is immortal. That's the man in you that cannot die. I meet them, those who are called dead, and I tell you, they're not dead. Nothing dies. Everything is restored. Everything is restored, but the day will come, you will go beyond restoration, and you will resurrect. And who is resurrecting? God. And God in you awakens, and you are God, because God is the Father of David. That is the way you know you are God. I will tell of the decree of the Lord. He has said unto me, "Thou art my son. Today I have begotten thee." Psalm 2:7. These are the words of David. What is going to happen to you? Then you'll know you are God. You have no other way of knowing that you are God unless God's only son calls you Father. For no one knows who the son is except the Father, and no one knows who the Father is except the son, and anyone to whom the son chooses to reveal him. Luke 10:22. So no one has seen God, but the only Son who is in his bosom has made him known. John 1:18. He comes out of you and calls you Father, and then you know who you are. And I'm telling you, every one of you, because you and I were chosen in him before the foundation of the world. Ephesians 1:4. Chosen for the purpose of receiving the gift of God, which is his glory, for he gives me himself. And in giving me himself, if he is a father, he gives me his son. You can't give me yourself in part, give it to me in totality. So if you are a father, then where is your son? Your son must be my son. He gives me his son. So he is so loved, he gave us his only begotten son, John 3:16. To whom? To you, to me, to every child born of woman. So every one of us will become fully aware that we are God. And yet I will know you as Jim. I will know you as Jan, but I will also know that you are God. I will know that you are soul and know you are God. I will know you as Bill and know you are God. I will know every one of you and the unnumbered billions that are not known to me here. In that day, I'll know them all and still know them all as God, for there's nothing but God. When the curtain comes down on the final act, we are all God. We are then the glory of God. So we will finish the work. He said, "I have finished the work thou gavest me to do. Now glorify thou me with thine own self, with the glory that I had with thee before that the world was." John 17, 4-5. It's returning now. Memory returns and every man becomes God. But now do not fail to apply the law. Blessed is the man who delights in the law of the Lord. In all that he does, he prospers. Psalm 1123. You name it and you can be it. You just name it. And if you dare to assume that you are it and view the world from that assumption, instead of thinking of it, you will crystallize it. You will actually manifest it in this world. that definition of imagination, I'll go along with it to a certain point, up to a point that things present are sense-perceived and called real. Things absent are called imagination, but man being all imagination, man must be wherever he is in imagination. So I need not be anchored to where my senses dictate. I can stand here and assume that I am elsewhere, and then if I assume that I am elsewhere, let me anchor myself there and view the world from it. If I view the world from it, I should see this place as I would see it if I were physically there. I can't see it surrounding me or under me, for then I did not move in imagination. Therefore, if I move in imagination, then I must think of where I was physically and see it elsewhere. I can't see it where I am in imagination and be moved, for all motion. Well, I can't tell myself that I have moved by a frame of reference. If I have moved relative to this room, let me look and see. Where am I now? I must have moved, for motion can be detected only by a change of position relative to another object. Where is the object? I assume that I am now, and I name it. If I am elsewhere, let me think of this room. Well, I can't see it as I now see it. If I see it as I now see it, then I didn't move. I can only move if I see it differently. Well, now, if I move and now I stand in my home, sitting in my chair in the living room, let me think of this club. I must see it away down on Catalina and feel myself at home on Carroll Street, and then think of the club. It can't be here. It must be way down on Catalina. Then I've moved. For man being all imagination, he must be wherever he is in imagination. If I practice this, it becomes easier and easier. I just read a story of a very dear friend of mine who used to come to me. Not to my meetings, but I would say once a month she came home from a personal appointment in New York City. She was killed last week in a car driven by her husband. And I can now see this perfectly lovely, gracious lady. She had a home in Oyster Bay, Long Island. She had her apartment in New York City. Her name is possibly one of the most prominent names in America. The name is Roosevelt. She was of the Teddy Roosevelt branch. Her name was Grace. Her husband was Archibald. Teddy was governor of New York. He was vice president of our country. He was president of our country, a very powerful, wonderful leader. He did not leave, as so many presidents leave, a fortune. He didn't go in there to make a fortune. He went in there to lead the country. And he said, I don't consider public opinion. I perform what I think is best for our country. I feed them what they ought to know. I feed them what I think is best for our country. But he didn't go in there to make a personal fortune, and he came out without a personal fortune. So she, in spite of her name, did not have a personal fortune. She had a home in Oyster Bay, Long Island, and a lovely apartment, beautifully furnished from things that her father-in-law had given her. If she did not rent her New York apartment for the summer, she could not open her home in Long Island. She could not afford it. Being a lovely home in a very wonderful, fashionable area of New York City, she always got a wonderful price paid in advance for 3 or 4 months. Then came the end of the season where they aren't looking for any homes, and she came to see me. She said, Neville, I am desperate. Unless I rent the place in New York City, we can't open our home in Long Island. I said, all right, it's rented, and you're living in Long Island. Oh, but she said, Neville, I can't do that. I said, tonight you sleep in your home in Long Island. But she said, I can't do that. How could I go and sleep there? I said, you don't do it physically. Tonight you sleep physically in New York City in your apartment, but in your imagination, which is the only reality, you sleep in your home in Long Island, and then you think of your place in New York. The reason why you see it across the East River is because you're physically sleeping in Long Island. And the reason you're sleeping there is because you rented it. Put them all together, that's why you're there. She said to me, if it rents, I'll call you. I said, there's no ifs about it. The only if is if you do it, then you'll call me. I took her to the elevator. She went downstairs, went back to her place. The next day at 9 a.m, Mrs. Roosevelt is on the phone. She said, Neville, this is Grace Roosevelt. I said, how are you, Mrs. Roosevelt? She said, I am calling you from Long Island, where I slept last night physically. When I went home, no one came at all over the period that you rent places. But as I got home soon after I got home, an agent called and asked if I could show the apartment. Single man came in. He liked the place. Money meant nothing to him. He wanted immediate possession, but I meant immediate. I mean now. Well, she said, I can't get out now. I have to call my husband at the office. I don't care what you do. I want immediate possession, and here is my check in advance. You can call the bank to see if the check is good. She got out that day. She called her husband to meet her, and off they went to their home in Long Island. Well, she was just killed last week at the age of 73, and I think it was. He was driving. He wasn't injured, and the friend in the car was injured, but Grace was killed instantly. But at least she learned the law. She didn't come to the meetings very often because she said in her capacity she was a pillar of the Episcopal Church in New York City, also in Long Island. It would not be advisable to be seen in my meeting place. That would be slumming, but she always came to my home without any problem. One, she had her with her son. He came back from Egypt. He was in the State Department. He came with a huge big beard. And he said, "Neville, I'm embarrassed. It was long before people wore beards. Today it would be the thing to do." But he came back long before the young fellows wore beards. It was a huge big beard. She said, "Neville, I'm so embarrassed. I just don't want to walk down Fifth Avenue with him. I would make him walk ahead or walk behind me. Don't want to be seen with him. What must I do? Because he gets annoyed and will do nothing that his father or I suggest." I said, "How could you feel if you kissed him and he had no beard? You would kiss your son, wouldn't you?" "Oh, yes." "Well, then put your hand on his face and he doesn't have any beard. And then you kiss him and feel that smooth skin that is your son's face when he has no beard." "All right, I will do that." She didn't tell me. I opened the morning paper one morning and there's this big fashionable social wedding, and here was Mrs. Roosevelt and her husband, and here is her son, and here is the bride coming down the steps of the Episcopal Church, and he has no beard. So the next time she came to see me, I reminded her. I said, "You know, you came here last time about the beard, and the beard is off." She said, "Do you know why?" I said, "Yes, I know why, but you tell me why." "Well, the girl that he married refused to go through it unless he shaved." She saw the physical fact. I said, "No, that wasn't it. You promised me that you would kiss him and feel his smooth skin, and if you would feel the smooth skin, it would come off." She said, "I did do that, but the girl demanded it." So she goes back to the physical causation, and it wasn't so at all. There is no natural effect with the natural cause. Every natural effect has an imaginal cause, and the natural only seems. So she still is going to insist that the girl wanted the beard off, and that's why he took it off. Well, now, she knows better. She's now in a world just like this. At least she learned the lesson of the law. She didn't learn the promise, because when I spoke to her, I didn't have the promise. I had not realized it. You know the promise because it only happened to me 12 years ago this coming month. So those who knew me before have not heard from me the promise. Those who have known me since, they know the promise. So I ask you tonight to please take it seriously. Watch your every imaginal act. And I will say to everyone, don't take anything lightly. Don't voice an opinion that may be embarrassing or hurtful to yourself or to another, even though reason dictates it. Because reason could dictate that this is the fact. For I've seen so many similar cases that this is going to be so and so. Your words are the words of God. Oh, what have I said? What have I done, O all-powerful words? Blake, Jerusalem. This is one of the later lectures, so I do not have the question and answers that followed, but it's a really good summary of imagination. And if there's anyone out there that wants to know Neville Goddard's teachings regarding imagination, this would be a really good lecture to refer to. Notice he does say earlier that many of the things I've imagined haven't happened. But he takes responsibility for that. So if you've used the techniques of Neville Goddard and it didn't work, it's not because of anything in the outside world. It's because something that you did. There's some aspect of your imagining that was incorrect or didn't take. So he is clearly stating that the cause is always with you. And if you go back for events that have happened in your life, it's very easy to always find the physical cause. But the physical cause is not the actual initial cause. It is always imaginal. Once you accept this and really go back, you may not remember when you imagined it. It could be a fleeting moment. And the real warning that comes from this, that I say to you, every imaginal act must be watched carefully. Even a fleeting moment can be the initial cause for a tragic event in your life. So it's very important that you become aware of this. Not to be afraid. It's empowering once you realize that you have control over your reality. It can also be a major pain in the butt, right? It's devastating for some people, this law of assumption is very harsh and difficult. And you see people all over the world struggling. Why are they struggling? Because they haven't come to grips with the fact that their imagination creates reality. Every imaginal act. Every imaginal act is for you. Now notice the examples that he gives. They're all examples of feeling. When he's talking to Mrs. Roosevelt in that particular case, she's saying, where do you fall asleep? You fall asleep in this other house. Do you feel your son's soft skin? He removes his beard. He always adds a feeling aspect as a part of his imaginal act in his examples. So always remember that particular aspect. That's why he wrote the book, The Feeling is the Secret. Your feeling aspect must be a part of what you're imagining for it to be effective. But even then, there are feeling aspects, even when you have fleeting imaginal acts. So this really captures a lot of different stories that he's had in the past and summarizes his belief in imagination. So imagine greatly and lovely. Imagine lovingly for the people around you and good things will happen. Just remember that you have this power. Embrace it. It is the law. In any case, tell me in particular in the comments about your own experiences using Neville's techniques and how your imagination has affected your reality. Sharing these stories is very powerful and will help other people to find faith in this procedure. In any case, all episodes of The Reality Revolution can always be found at therealityrevolution.com. And welcome to The Reality Revolution.